Watching oil companies maneuver is a little bit like navigating icebergs. It's wise to remember that most of the important stuff is happening under the surface. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. What do you think about ExxonMobil teaming up with TransCanada on the natural gas pipeline? Our number is 1-800-478-8255, toll-free, and Anchorage a local call of 550-8422. Email talk@APRN.org. Everybody agrees it brings the gas line closer, but how much closer? On Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Well, if you ever did a jigsaw puzzle, you know how it is when there's a piece missing. It's just hard to make sense of the pattern. It's really aggravating. And we had a giant piece that was missing from the jigsaw puzzle until the 11th of June, 2009. What we had was the AGIA deal, TransCanada and the state of Alaska entering into a contract for certain tax abatements and $500 million in state money if certain benchmarks are met towards a natural gas pipeline delivering product into the grid in Canada. And then on the other side, you had two of the people who produce the gas, two of the companies that produce the gas, which now has nowhere to go, so they're just producing oil, saying they would build a gas line, but they didn't like the terms of the state thing, so they made their own company called Denali. So we had BP, and we had ConocoPhillips, but the missing piece was Exxon, because they hold more potential gas than the other two, and they had made no commitment either way. Now they have. And they've thrown in with TransCanada, and suddenly we're left trying to figure out what it all means. Some people say, well, this agreement is so vague that it doesn't mean anything. But it would appear if Exxon is actually committing to spend some $70 million in the next year, $70 million is something. Joining us today for this discussion, and really we want to hear both of us, what the listeners have to say about this, what the people in Alaska have to say about what's their first blush on this deal. But to help respond is another journalist. So instead of having experts here who are going to analyze this and tell you, answer your questions and tell you what it all means, we've got two journalists who are both trying to figure out what it all means. So I'm joined by David Ebner. He is the national correspondent for the Toronto Globe and Mail in Vancouver, British Columbia. David, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks for having me, Steve. I appreciate being here.
So what is the weather like today in Vancouver?
You know, we've had a run of pristine weather. I think everybody's actually waiting for a bit of rain. This time a year ago, it was raining quite a bit, but we've had an excellent stretch. What about up there?
Oh, it's a little too dry, and people are worried about fires, and it's warm enough now where you get these convection storms that are making lightning and fire. So things are people a little nervous, but they're loving that it is has been such a nice summer. Last year, we hardly had a summer in much of Alaska.
Yeah, I think we're having a lot of luck up and down the coast.
Well, let's turn to this to our rash speculations about what this means with ExxonMobil. For you, you have the additional twist of knowing that Exxon was already the majority holder in Imperial, and Imperial already has a pending proposal for a gas line into the grid from Mackenzie Valley.
Yeah, so, next door neighbors up there.
So here you see, from your point of view, you're kind of seeing maybe that Exxon is jumping. These are thought to be sort of competing gas lines, although many people say, no, all that gas will be needed. But from your point of view, you're seeing in terms of investment that Exxon might be switching sides here.
It looks like that at least a little bit, if not a lot. There's a lot more gas on the North Shore, the North Slope, excuse me, of Alaska than there is in the Mackenzie Delta. That's already been discovered. Granted, Alaska, it's a lot further away instead of 1,200 kilometers, excuse me for using the metric.
Oh, it's okay.
It's about three times the distance for Alaska. But again, a lot more gas, and I think Exxon doesn't move. $70 million is so, I mean, they can spend that in a couple seconds, you know. But it is a commitment. And I think the bigger thing is it's a public commitment with a governor and a process. Exxon was against quite vehemently. Remember, they had a deal with Murkowski and the other two oil companies. The fact that Exxon made a public move, I think, is the most significant thing. On one hand, nothing's really happening, but symbolically, at least, I think a lot has happened. But again, the biggest thing we'll have to see is next year, 2010, what companies make what commitments to which pipeline. Those are much more tangible moves.
Yeah, and I think the people of Alaska might have a little bit more political power in this process than they realize. If you go back and watch the history, David, from what happened was that it was basically there were a number of things probably that Alaskans had come to dislike about Frank Murkowski by the time this gas line deal came from him. But the fact of the matter is it was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, people just took one look at that thing and said, this is nothing but a giveaway, and they sneezed, and Frank Murkowski was history, and Sarah Palin had taken his place.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know the exact opinion polls in Alaska regarding the current governor, but the state and the people have won the collective process. IGEA was the 5 points to benefit Alaskans tangibly. And we have essentially Exxon endorsing it, whereas BP and Conoco did not. So the most important energy company has, which again is a victory for the state of Alaska and a bit of a sea change. You know, it doesn't put a shovel in the ground tomorrow, but it makes that shovel less conceptual than it was before this announcement.
You've been covering oil and gas for a while, David?
Yeah, about 5 years, with a fairly close eye on it.
So, and you've managed to keep, I'm sure, an eye on the Alberta hub and all the changes that have been going on there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, and you wouldn't be any stranger to the, although it's an American concept, but this idea of getting your investors for a pipeline and having an open season so that you know that you have your customers must be an interesting process for you to watch from Canada.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely is. And for these massive projects, $26 billion U.S. at least is the tentative price. Early next year, after Exxon and TransCanada do some more work, they'll come out with a more refined estimate. Chances are it's probably a little higher. But you can't get a project like that underway without people signing up long-term commitments. And for the company signing up a long-term commitment, it's a balance sheet commitment, so it's not taken lightly. A lot of factors are happening on the American side, including the loan guarantees in Congress, which might be increased. And in Canada, there's pressure on the government from some quarters to support the northern development on Canada's side. So cynics, and maybe they're correct, look at Exxon specifically as playing one government against each other in terms of subsidies. But in both cases, the pipelines are extremely important for economic development.
Yeah, we have deliberately not included, in other words, not brought in as a guest, although calls are totally welcome from the governor's team or ConocoPhillips or Exxon or TransCanada, any of the above. But what we really want to hear is from Alaskans what they make of this. Because if they hold a large, if Alaskans themselves hold a big bargaining chip in this process, as it appears that they did in replacing Frank Murkowski with Sarah Palin, once again, they have a voice in where it's going to go next with the gas line. And a question, and it's difficult because of the conflicting loyalties. On the one hand, you have TransCanada, who theoretically for many was the good guy because they responded to AGEA. And that sort of made BP and ConocoPhillips the bad guy because they were going to do it on their own. But nobody would really say that, I don't think, because, hey, if they get the money together and actually build the gas line, that benefits everybody. And Exxon is going to be the one that's left behind. So they're not that much of a bad guy. But the one that many Alaskans are not happy with at all would be ExxonMobil. And that's because of their dilatory tactics on that oil spill of 1989. I mean, granted, it's always been the corporation's strategy to fight every piece of litigation, and they've done that for many, many years. But nonetheless, to see a damage award that was originally the largest against an American corporation ever reduced to one-tenth that amount, that sort of sticks in a lot of Alaskans' craws, including the governor. But the governor appears to have gotten over it, and here we are. So I'd really like to hear what Alaskans have to say about this new involvement of Exxon and what it does to their attitude towards AGEA. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And our email is talk@aprn.org. And you're welcome to put on your tinfoil hats and indulge in conspiracy theories and everything, because we're just going to be speculating. Most of it is under the surface, and we're all really kind of just guessing. And you were probably, David, kind of curious as to what Alaskans, how Alaskans respond to this.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say on guessing, on such a long-term project, if it's built, if it's in service 10 years from now, as is the goal, and then it's in service for 20 to 50 years, Exxon has some smart people working for it. TransCanada definitely has smart people working for it. But we can only be so smart. We all watch the financial crisis, and sometimes smart people make disastrous decisions. So I think the companies are they don't know the answers either. And a big question is how much shale gas, which is gas trapped in hyper-tight rock, a lot of which has been found with new technology down in Louisiana and Texas, so way, way closer to the market, how that new gas supply affects potential projects like Alaska. You can't put a $30 billion pipeline in the ground without some certainty. So the companies, there's some guesswork involved in some of these forecasts. One factor is Exxon doesn't really have that much territory in these new shale plays. So they got to look where they can get their own gas. And right now, the price of gas is extremely depressed as well in terms of trying to sell it. Not that that situation lasts forever, but there's so many factors at play. And the company shouldn't be looked at it as geniuses that know everything.
No, but they do tend to try and have long planning horizons. And let's just look at this shale play, for instance, because there are a number of different ones, as I understand it, not just the Gulf of Mexico, but it's all under the Allegheny Plateau as well, that they're just think they can drill deeper and do some fracking, and they'll be able to extract a good deal of natural gas.
Yeah, it's all over the place. Northeast British Columbia, here in the province where I'm working. Barnett Shale is the original one in Texas, down Louisiana, the Appalachians, up into Quebec, the province, Canadian province to the east. Yeah, and it depends how quickly. The Russia supply that came on last year is a big reason why the price of gas is so low. And a lot of drilling was postponed because there's no point to drill a well that's only profitable at $6 per 1,000 cubic feet when the price of gas right now is 4 and less, and possibly going down to 2. But again, with the pipeline, if your pipeline's in service in 2018, you got to think, what's the price then? Is more shale discovered? And some of these shale plays won't really pump out forever, you know? They kind of come out fast and heavy and then fade away. And they all have different characteristics. And again, another factor I mentioned, Exxon doesn't really have a position in shale right now. Of course, they could buy a company with a large position in shale. Exxon's big advantage is they have $25 billion in cash in their pocket, which no other company in energy or elsewhere can come even close. So Exxon has a lot of... It can do really not whatever it wants, but close to whatever it wants. And so running back to the endorsement, as it were, of TransCanada, they ran a lot of scenarios. And by putting their stamp on the TransCanada project, that's where I saw the significance, even though it's still very early stage.
I remember years ago, our guest is David Ebner. He is the a national correspondent in Vancouver for the Toronto Globe and Mail in Canada, and covers oil and gas for them, but also other issues. One thing that when I first moved into oil country up here, I was told was, you know, the companies are careful about what they tell you, but a lot of it, as a reporter, but a lot of it is because they're very, even more careful about what they tell one another and the signals that they're sending one another, that they're very, very, this is an extremely competitive business, and we should never forget this. And you've probably learned this, too.
It's interesting. We're friends and enemies all at once, and a good illustration in terms of the companies involved, TransCanada Pipelines of Calgary, the proponent, is a huge gas pipeline company. Their biggest customer on those pipelines is BP, so obviously an opponent in Alaska, but its biggest commercial customer on its whole system. And then with Conoco, again, another opponent of TransCanada. TransCanada and Conoco are major partners, are partners on a major oil pipeline that's about to be built from Alberta to Texas. So, yeah, again, friends and enemies. The ties that bind and push people apart are quite amazing, actually.
They really are. What is the liquids production now coming out of the tar sands up there in Alberta? As last time I checked, it was about 1.5 million barrels a day.
Yeah, you know, roughly speaking, it's still about that level. It doesn't really tick up. It doesn't shoot up day by day. It's more a year-by-year process. So Canada's probably 2.5 in general, and the tar sands are a little less than 1.5. Just recently, forecast, the longer-term forecast for that region was pared back quite significantly as investment plans, have some of which have fallen by the wayside. Some were too ambitious, and then two ambitious projects, proposed projects, ran up against the credit crisis and were proven to be unrealistic. So I think a little less oil will come out of that region than previously been expected. And for Americans, even though the United States produces a tremendous amount of oil, third most in the world, the biggest importer to America is actually Canada, which a lot of people don't know. I think a lot of people think it's Saudi Arabia, but it is actually Canada.
And a great deal of that is coming down pipelines out of Alberta now.
Exactly, exactly.
Now the production details, for those who don't know, for these tar sands, they do require a significant carbon input to get the fuel out, right?
Yeah, it's, if you think of back in Texas, 1901, at Spindletop, kind of poke a straw in the ground, or maybe Saudi Arabia as well, you poke a straw in the ground and it just shoots out and it's ready to go and it's almost gasoline quality oil. That oil, they call it easy oil. It wasn't easy back then, I can tell you that. Not that I was there, you know, but it wasn't easy then. It was hard to find. It's always been hard to find. But the oil we're working with these days, the tar sands, it's oil, just to simplify it, oil mixed in dirt. And it takes a tremendous amount of energy to wash the dirt out and take the oil and upgrade it to a synthetic crude oil, which then further has to go into a refinery to become jet fuel or gasoline, scraping the bottom of the barrel, as it were.
A very good way to put it. And, you know, we have much a similar situation in Alaska. A lot of people don't know, but Prudhoe Bay is actually greatly outweighed by a deposit known as West Sac, which is the same problem, that it's too cold and they can't get it to decongeal enough. They've tried solvents and heating and all sorts of things to really get this to produce at a good rate.
Yeah.
So and actually, there's many cases like this. I would love to hear from a peak oil person, because I love to argue this with the peak oil people. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, a local call of 550-8422. Our email is talk@APRN.org. And our first caller, David Ebner, is William from Fairbanks, who introduces yet another factor into this complicated oil business cocktail that we're cooking up today. William, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, good morning. As a about a 40-year resident of a state, it kind of gags me to hear Exxon paired with corporate responsibility or a good faith or interests of the state of Alaska, because I've been witness to the 20 years litigation after the oil spill and the Point Thompson situation, and So thinking that Exxon has any element of the states of Alaska's interest in mind when it proposes something is a non-starter for me. If the people in the state of Alaska are serious about developing a gas line, the first thing, of course, they should do is put a tax on the undeveloped reserves up in Prudhoe. It's a commonplace thing in other countries to tax these undeveloped gas reserves in order to expedite the development of them.
Yeah, William, as a matter of fact, I was just reading my Alaska history the other day in the in Jerry Macbeth and Matt Berman's book. They describe how Alaska wouldn't have had any money before the pipeline was built unless it did tax reserves. That's how they got their money. So there is a precedent for this.
Yes. If, as again, I said, if the state is serious about developing it, instead of having Exxon or the other major oil companies put the spin on things for 10 or 15 years and then decide not to do anything, at least they would be paying for that privilege if they had to pay tax on the undeveloped gas reserves. It has been proposed in the Alaska legislature, but again, as somebody has witnessed 40 years of politics and the corruption, the degradation of our legislative system being prostituted to the oil companies, it hasn't passed. But again, I would say every Alaskan that hears this should support a tax on the undeveloped gas reserves if they are in favor of expediting, promoting a gas line being constructed in our state. I'll hang up and listen with interest to your commentator and other callers.
All right, William, thank you so much. It's valuable to get the insight of an old-timer who's watched this thing change. And the fact of the matter is it would take a tremendous sea change inside the legislature to pass a reserves tax, and that's the reason it's once again subject of a ballot measure, although it lost a popular election here in Alaska before. I wonder, do you have a perspective on that, David Ebner, over from Canada, the idea that Alaska would try and tax those gas reserves as a way of making more of an incentive that they get produced? I mean, do you think it can make that much of a difference when you're looking at an investment that goes, you know, in the multi-tens of billions of dollars?
Yeah, I first of all, I admire William's old school chutzpah. The world has changed somewhat, and I'm not sure that the Republican governor would support such a kind of what I suppose would be a bit of a left-wing pro-citizen measure. People say Exxon has a lot of options. It does, but its options are as well somewhat limited, and the Alaskan gas is one of its very major future investment opportunities. To William's point that Exxon isn't benevolent, it certainly isn't. Canadian writer, the name slips to mind right now, kind of painted a corporation as a psychopath out for itself. But that's how they're designed. The corporation is set up to make money as aggressively as possible, and Exxon is arguably the most successful capitalist out there, whether they're nice guys or not, you know? In
yeah.
terms of the reserves, I think a tangible point, a financial analyst investor I spoke with suggested that some backroom pressure on Exxon in terms of use it or lose it, in terms of the leases, also was a factor in Exxon's kind of about-face in terms of essentially endorsing the AGIA process, which it denounced earlier. The idea that Point Thompson was somewhat settled, and now there's work happening up there, and that I think there was some pressure exerted, and I wonder if it stems all the way back to Washington as well, because Exxon, again, doesn't just do something for nothing, and it works governments as hard as possible.
Yeah, and I think we need to bear in mind that even a corporation as monolithic as ExxonMobil, now called ExxonMobil because it's absorbed Mobil, experiences change as time goes on. The oil industry has been about change since it was established, and there have been changes at the top at ExxonMobil, and this could be in a way, I won't say exactly kinder and gentler, but a different strategy from the corporation than the one that decided to fight tooth and nail the punitive damage award so many years ago.
Yeah, and there's different corporate strategies over time. Oil companies, I would describe them, at least back in the day, as fairly hostile. They're becoming, I would say, somewhat more enlightened, but again, I'm doing it for the profit motive. They see the way the world's going, denying climate change and funding climate change deniers. I think they've seen that that probably isn't the most genius strategy in the world. I know Imperial a little better than Exxon itself. So Imperial is essentially Exxon Canada, 70% owned by Exxon. The new CEO there, Bruce March, is just a huge, huge, huge change from the last CEO. The last CEO had a very successful run. He's a nice guy personally, but he's a tough businessman. Bruce March is also a tough businessman. But as it were, I don't want to use the word Exxon and progressive together, but relatively speaking, a lot more progressive than previously.
Yeah,
I think that change comes from Exxon in Texas.
Well, what we're seeing here is the appearance of a new player, Shell, which is interested in offshore stuff and really not a player in this gas line thing at all so far. Then we have the independents who are on the rise here, the Wildcatters and so forth even. And then we have the situation where Exxon has not bid in recent lease sales at all. They simply have chosen not to. And yet here they had this big lease holding that they'd had for decades at Point Thompson, which there's a pipeline running about halfway to. But it turns out, apparently, according to Marty Rutherford, that you can't just produce the gas out of it. You have to produce the oil also. So we have the capitalization necessary to get anything out of it that's been substantial. And we finally have a move, kind of a guarded move from both sides now, but yes, a move to do something at Point Thompson. Now we'll see what happens when they actually do something. And then the next thing would be when the next lease sale that comes up, whether we actually see bids from ExxonMobil. That would be a true sea change in Alaska and the oil business.
And I'm an outsider, obviously, but I do understand how long and deep the anger runs to Exxon, and rightly and fairly. Corporations, in a way, don't have memories. You know, they look forward. And I wonder, it's a good point, Steve. We'll see what the next actions are.
All right. We're talking with David Ebner. He is national correspondent for Globe and Mail. The Globe and Mail, it's a national Canadian newspaper out of Toronto. But he works out of Vancouver, and he's with us by telephone. We're both just journalists. We're both just trying to figure this out. We both have kind of known the oil and gas industry for some years, but we're really guessing. So much of this is really under the surface. And our subject is ExxonMobil, natural gas, and AGEA. What does it mean that Exxon has thrown in with TransCanada? Some people say it doesn't really mean anything. And ExxonMobil itself has said that it wants to continue to look for the fiscal stability that it was looking for before. Well, they get 5 years of fiscal stability out of AGEA, but that's really nowhere near, I think, what they're really looking for. They have more of a longer planning horizon for that because the gas doesn't even start. We're looking at completion maybe like 2018 if everything stayed on schedule.
Yeah, we're Alaskans are going to get back to, it'll be deja vu all over again. The battles over tax, long-term tax deals, which was occurring under Murkowski as well, and a lot of what led to AGEA, those things still have to be settled. So for the people that observe, well, nothing's actually really happened, it's correct in the fact that a lot more needs to happen. But again, the game is underway much more seriously than it was when it was just TransCanada.
Much more seriously. It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest is David Ebner of the Toronto Globe and Mail as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. Operating a forklift is serious business, and operators are required to be properly trained and certified. The emotional and financial damage can be severe when a family member never comes home from work or comes home with a debilitating injury due to a forklift accident. Training information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking gas today. ExxonMobil has some $25 billion it can invest, and the question is, has it decided that it's ready to invest in gas in Alaska? Last week, ExxonMobil threw in with TransCanada and the Alaska Gas Line Act, AGEA, and that act is deliberately designed to provide advantages to Alaskans and get a gas line going. So where do we stand with this now, and what do Alaskans think about Exxon's new attitude toward Alaska, if indeed it is a new attitude? So far, the callers have been very suspicious. My guest, David Ebner of the Toronto Globe and Mail, and he looks at it from the Canadian perspective. So it's a very interesting discussion. Let's go to Morris, joins us from Nunapichuk. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Morris. Whoops, we lost Morris. Dang. Well, let me bring up what I think Morris might have wanted to bring up, which is, how are we going to get the fuel in the state if it's shipped out of the state? As you can imagine, David, Alaskans are concerned when their fuel costs are so high, and here we are exporting. This is one of the reasons why there's many who support the in-state option for a gas line and exporting then the gas through some LNG means or something like that to whoever would buy it. There is still a lack of LNG ports, we must say.
Yeah, it seems that GEA deals with this fairly well. I mean, if it had gone the Murkowski way, I think what they would have called a bullet line, that is, from the North Slope and straight out of state without a wave or a stop, was the way it probably would have went. But AGEA seems to require, we'll see how it plays out, multiple options.
That adds to the cost.
Yeah, and TransCanada is a pipeline builder. Is keen to build pipelines. The shippers, Exxon, BP, and Conoco, are keen to see the pipeline built as cheaply as possible. But again, the fact that Exxon has essentially endorsed AGEA really, for now, ups the odds that we see spur lines, as it were, Alaskan fuel to power Alaska, and then also the option to have an LNG port down the south of the state at Valdez.
Do you think there's any validity to this conspiracy theory about, Canada will strip out all the liquids out of that natural gas before it gets out of the country, because there is actually some kind of statute, as I understand, in Alberta that allows that to happen, that they actually can tax that?
I think the idea of stripping out the liquids when it comes out to the hub at boundary, or it depends how the actual route will work. But I would see there's going to be a lot of processing on the North Slope, but I can see liquids being stripped out down the line. I mean, I don't know if that's an evil, bad thing. I think the companies will undertake things like that where it makes the most financial sense, and not so much to betray Alaskans by any stretch.
Yeah, well, obviously they have interest in this, so they're gonna try and it's not just one company right now, so it's very interesting from that point. And then I guess we should point out these liquids constitute propane as well as other things, and propane is the fuel that probably is your biggest cost problem in Alaska, along with diesel.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think every jurisdiction deals with facts like this. Alberta exports a lot of crude oil, doesn't really refine much into gasoline. What's refined in the province is used in the province and in Western Canada. But then some people in Alberta will be like, well, why don't we build another refinery to produce more gasoline and sell it to Seattle? But no oil company seems too keen to do that. And so, to an extent, the resources leave half-processed. And why isn't the higher-valuing processing happen in a place? But, again, not to be on the oil company side by any stretch, but if it made economic sense, maybe it would occur. And it probably is occurring the way it probably makes the most economic sense. But that's what happens when you reduce life to what's the cheapest and what's the most efficient. It's not necessarily going to benefit the people that maybe you think it should benefit.
Let's go to David, joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, David.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Dave.
Hello.
I've got my tinfoiler Burberry Stetson Grundon's aluminum foil rabbit ears all wound up here. So, not to get too far out on this, but I'm a person who has been following the development of the tar sands and, of course, our oil industry for years. I'm a lifelong resident approaching 60. And I've read a couple of books. I'd like to ask Dave if he might have read them, one of which is by Andrew Nikiforuk, a tar sands activist, Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent.
Yeah, an excellent journalist. I do know Andrew.
Oh, great. I actually invited him to Alaska. And, of course, the other book was the 2007 National Business Book Award winner in Canada by William Marsden, Stupid to the Last Drop, How Alberta is Bringing Environmental Armageddon to Canada and Doesn't Seem to Care.
And, yeah, I know. I don't know William personally, but I know the book. I would put a little more faith in Andrew, but they're both definitely very interesting books.
Yeah, that's my take on it. So I guess I'd have to ask, in light of all the hoopla that's going on, and in the presence of what seems to be a virtual news blackout in Alaska, even regarding the 1,600 ducks in one day last year being killed in the ponds, is What is your take on the ultimate disposition of Alaska's gas based on the glut? I mean, the worldwide glut. Can it be pointing in any other direction than the Alberta tar sands financially?
Well, that's a tinfoil hat, all right. Let's see, David. What do you think of that?
I definitely think that's an excellent observation. So everybody's up to speed, to produce the oil out of the tar sands, like I mentioned, it kind of dirt-wrapped oil. It takes a lot of energy, and that energy generally comes from natural gas-powered electricity generation. One of the ideas is the Mackenzie Valley natural gas pipeline down from Inuvik is basically on a direct line to the tar sands, not quite, but essentially, that all that gas would be used in the tar sands. Some people call it a conspiracy theory. I think that's the most likely scenario if that pipeline gets built. If an Alaska pipeline comes down, it doesn't go directly, but the seller of natural gas just wants to sell it to the person closest who's willing to buy it. And I do agree that it's likely that there's so much gas would come out of Alaska, it certainly couldn't all be burned in the tar sands. But I think a chunk, if it doesn't go directly there, it frees up other gas to go there. So it's not necessarily a North Slope molecule. Ends up being burned in northeastern Alberta, but effectively so, at least to an extent. That's a bigger policy question we have to ask, that especially the Canadian government has to wrestle with. We have a conservative government in Canada. It's, if we, roughly speaking, kind of Republican-type administration, and not really the ones to think more progressively in terms of green and how quickly we develop or how slowly we develop an oil resource. It's develop it as quickly as possible will be their stance. So right now, the policy discussion isn't too advanced. But if we see a change
right.
in government,
not to take this any further, really, but I read the Globe and Mail, also the Edmonton paper, and also the Tie E to
yep.
get a pretty wide perspective on it. But I just think a lot of this has been, if not withheld, severely edited. And I'd just like more Alaskans to become aware of what's actually going on in Alberta. I actually work in the oil industry and the marine industry, so I'm not for stopping everything, but I'd just like intelligent observation before taking these giant leaps. But thank you very much for coming up and talking with us.
Yeah, for sure.
On the phone and talk anyway.
Yeah, for sure. I appreciate that you called in.
Yeah, David. So it looks to me like, David Ebner, that... from what you've told us, that actually the investment is getting a little limp in the tar sands for whatever reason, and that this is more gas than they could possibly burn through existing plants or any idea of any plants that might be built. I think I got that out of what you were saying, and that but the idea that there wouldn't be some kind of a transaction involving this gas in the tar sands would be naive. I mean, it's right there, so it seems that there would be. It would be most efficient to do that.
Yeah, if I'm standing next to you and I say, I want to buy a lot of your natural gas, and that reduces your shipping costs to the minimal amount, you're going to sell it to me, right? It's not a political decision, it's business. And so that's why governments have to take whatever actions they feel are necessary, and citizens should advocate and lobby for what they think is necessary. And
let me put it this to you, and this is, you know, certainly brought up in those books that that David was referring to, a person should be, if they don't like the tar sands and think it's crazy to for the BTUs you get out of it to put that much carbon into the atmosphere, they really need to be pushing for a carbon tax internationally.
Yeah, many economists are pro carbon tax because it's a simple, effective measure. If you make something more expensive, there will be a response on the part of the consumer. So an oil company probably isn't too keen for a carbon tax because you're increasing the price of their product. Actually, British Columbia is the first jurisdiction in North America to have introduced a carbon tax. It came in with much kind of annoyed fanfare about a year ago, 3 cents a liter on gasoline, which isn't really very much. I mean, the price of gasoline can go up and down that amount in a day. But it will rise over time, and it came in at a time when gasoline prices were so high. The issue has kind of faded away, and the government that introduced it won re-election in May, and it was an issue during the election. But I think a carbon tax, beyond my own opinion, a lot of economists support a carbon tax. If we want to quell or at least slow down the burning of carbon, taxing it is the most effective way to do it.
So who's the party in charge there now?
Here in British Columbia, it's called the Liberal Party. They're more conservative, small C conservative than your typical Liberal Party. And then nationally, it is the big C conservative party, which again would be a bit more like a Republican Party in the United States.
Uh-huh. And in Alberta, who's running things there?
Also a conservative party. And some of these lines blur, actually. In terms of the political situation in British Columbia, it was the more, as it were, right-wing leading party that introduced the carbon tax, and it was the more left-wing leading party that opposed it.
Now you're making my head spin.
Yeah, I know. You get a lot of strange bedfellows in this new world of of green. I think the local, more right-wing liberal party just looked at the next 20 years and said, this makes sense. We got to get out ahead of it. And it was quite a political gamble because, you know, proposing new taxes isn't the most genius re-election strategy in the world. It worked out for them in the end. The voters, I think, concluded broadly that their economic stewardship was the best. But they did, at the same time, endorse a new tax, which was extraordinary, frankly.
Yeah, really. Revolutionary, even. Let's go to Steve, joins the program from Fairbanks. Steve, you're on the air. Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Pretty good.
But I've got 2 points, really. One, the thought of Exxon coming in with TransCanada is quite appalling to me, the way they treated Alaskans up here. It seems to me they could have paid off their debt like they promised and made everybody happy and gave themselves a good outlook on things up here and showing that they're responsible for their actions and such. But that being said, my second point is this TransCanada pipeline is going to go from the North Slope down into Alberta. The whole tar sands things, you know, that rubs me wrong too. It seems like a lot of energy to, you know, produce that type of energy. It doesn't make sense to me, but I guess a third point I might have is Fairbanks fails EPA standards and air quality every winter because of the type of fossil fuels we use. And for 20 years, this oil pipeline has been here, and we haven't had natural gas in Fairbanks. And I guess I'd like to hear a little bit of opinions on your guys's end on why that is. Like, why doesn't Fairbanks have good, clean-burning natural fuels when we fail EPA air quality standards almost every winter?
Well, a guy in Vancouver is not going to know, but...
Yeah, I was going to follow you that one to you, Steve.
But, I think you basically... the situation is so bad that they actually truck in gas. They liquefy it and truck it in at this point. And you just, AGEA, theoretically, would deliver you gas.
Okay.
As I understand it, AGEA, there is a takeout point that would supply natural gas to Fairbanks. You'd still have to get the pipelines built, but it's not that far away.
Right. I mean, it seems to me they've been capping that natural gas up there for quite some time, and it seems to me like these large oil companies with $25 billion in their pocket are just kind of stashing it away up there, waiting for the prices to get sky high before they would ever send it down to us.
Well, yeah, but you see the problem with that one, Steve, is that the price is going the other way.
Right.
They gambled wrong on that one. You know, now it's almost the incentive really is to sit on it until some of these shale plays play out, if they do play out, or if something changes in the demand to where people are ready for more gas fuel than liquid fuel. But that's it's very interesting. And the market is different for natural gas. It's actually quite inflexible, even though the gas can move wherever it needs to move. The demand is very inflexible. It changes only very gradually. It's only when, like, power plants have to change or something like that that you get a big change. That's what drove the price down, is because there's no way for demand to expand as fast as supply is already expanding. It's marketplace 101.
Yeah. My home state of Pennsylvania has this possible large play. They're talking 500 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, and that's a whole lot closer to the markets they're shooting for, too. So I do see these other large plays playing a big factor in bringing the price of natural gas down. Do you think that could slow this process as well?
I think it already has, to tell you the truth. But it's very intriguing that Exxon has made this move at this time, and it's one of the things that reporters such as David and I are scratching our heads. Why would they do it when the price is doing nothing but dropping?
And like you said, it fluctuates up and down, and you know there's always going to be a demand for a clean burning fuel. So it's just, I mean, they can't predict that far out. To me, it should be just something. They should be, they being maybe Canada, the United States, or Alaska and the oil companies, however it plays out, they should just be going forward with it. And it'll be what the prices will be, what they'll be. I mean, the demand's always going to be there. And I can't imagine, as you know, we go into the future here with expanding economies around the globe, that you know there's not going to be a price increase at some point as we utilize these resources that eventually are going to run out.
All right,
or get
Steve.
Too expensive to extract.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Yeah, pretty much the way we see it too, right, David?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, it's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking gas today. We're talking about the significance, and we're speculating about the significance of Exxon's throwing in with TransCanada as Talk of Alaska continues.
Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
Email coming in to talk@aprn.org. Rhody and Willow says, hey, let's not forget about our propane. You know, but rather than see this gas go into tar sands, let's keep our eye on the ball and our own fuel prices here in Alaska. I think a good point. Tom in Fairbanks, how likely is it that either project can get the Canadian federal, provincial, and First Nation permits? Does TransCanada really have any that are still valid? It was an awfully long time ago when they got the license that they still brag about.
Yeah, exactly, and that was in the late 70s with a company called Foothills that TransCanada eventually bought. That email makes an excellent observation to the general point of it's a long road ahead, and there's a lot of Canada to traverse as well for this pipeline. The First Nations issue, I think, would be quite huge. It's definitely dogged the Mackenzie Valley pipeline as a regulatory review is stretched on and on and on and on.
Yeah, we in Alaska, we seem to have fairly settled law on that. And that's part of the reason they had the Native Claims Settlement Act. But in Canada, it doesn't seem nearly, it seems kind of wild and woolly in terms of the Aboriginal land resource and the easement claims.
In the West, it can be. The Mackenzie Valley Pipeline was actually sued by a First Nations group in the Southern Northwest Territories, which was settled for about $30 million eventually. In terms of Yukon and especially British Columbia, there's a lot of land whose claims have not been settled, so it's really a bit of a black hole. So part of the future of an Alaska pipeline hangs to an extent on Canada. And again, the email is keenly observes that it's a long, challenging road ahead.
All right. Bob in Fairbanks has been waiting for quite some time. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Yes. Good morning, Steve, and hello, Dave.
Hello, Bob.
I'm very interested in this, and as far as I can see, is what you're trying to do is promote the pipeline from here to the hub. And what energy savings would that be? And what would lower the cost if that is being taken out of state for the cost of the pipeline and the restrictions and how much you paid? And what is the quality of your fuel when there's five takeoffs or waves here in state? And what product would you have by the time it got to you at that distance? Why isn't the fuel used in state for smelters and forges to build some of the pipeline and some of the infrastructure in Alaska, all of this gas and oil being shipped elsewhere, and somebody else is benefiting and not in-state for Alaska-made? I would appreciate a comment, please. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Bob. I think that there's plenty to chew on in this. This is essentially the argument that former Governor Hickel is making. Hey, look, we own it. This is our gas. We ought to get our maximum benefit out of it and let it out of the state only once we've gotten what we can. So what do you think? You can't really argue with that, can you, David Ebner?
Oh, I think there's a lot of, as someone who doesn't live in the state, I don't want to say what should be done, but I think that's an important thing to mull. I think it would be maybe somewhat controversial to build an aluminum smelter or a gold mine or something like that. So you answer one issue and you create a whole bunch more. But it's a good question to try to keep in-state resources for the state. Of course, the state of Alaska has benefited tremendously from exporting natural gas. I know there's checks every year. And
well, oil, David.
Yeah.
Oil.
Yeah, sorry. Oil. Supports the Prudhoe Bay oil, of course. Exporting the oil has benefited the state tremendously. So the idea that the best way to benefit from something, keeping it in state, isn't necessarily the answer. But I think it's a worthy debate to have.
All right. Back to the email where William says, hey, wait a minute. Why is it, after four decades, Alaska does not have a strategic energy plan with goals based on modeled assumptions? Well, I don't think either one of us has an answer for that. But it's a good one to put into a future show. And thanks. Let's go to Jim. Joins the program from Eagle River. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Yes, everyone's excited about the pipeline, but it's going to take maybe 10 years or longer to finish it. It's going to take all the profit from the gas. The price of gas is going to be low for a long time because of the hydraulic fracturing method that's recently been developed for shale deposits. Now all the old empty fields are suddenly full of gas again, and they've paid all their overhead costs in their earlier development, so the price of gas is going to be cheap to the continental U.S., so we can't make any money that way. What we should do is run the railroad up to Prudhoe Bay, and then we can put gas on tanker cars and haul it anywhere in the state we want, put it on barges, ship it out of Anchorage.
Wow. Wait, what a concept. You right, get the tracks up there, and then you can move it wherever you need to where there are tracks.
And then the whole job is done within a year. It wouldn't take long to run the railroad tracks up where the gas is. We could take the flare gas to start with. They probably flare off more gas than the whole state consumes otherwise.
And would you use a route right where the Dalton Highway goes now?
Yeah, along, if it's practicable, which I imagine it is, yes.
Right. You'd have to get across the Yukon River somehow.
Well, they have a bridge. I'm sure another one could be built.
That was quite the engineering feat to do that one.
Well, there's been a lot of bigger bridges around the world, and it's just a railroad bridge. Gee, you know, we could take the trucks off the other bridge and just run the train across. We wouldn't need trucks if we had a railroad.
Jim, you were thinking really big here. I appreciate your call. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, so that's you're hearing some of that Alaskan can-do stuff there, David.
Yeah, I really admired it. I was going to say I don't want to duck and cover, but I can't say I feel qualified to comment.
Well, of course not. Let's go to Elisa in Elise in Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Elise.
Hello. How are you today?
Oh, pretty good.
Thanks for doing the program.
No, there's so much to be talked about. We haven't even scratched the surface yet. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a good week-long project here.
Yeah.
I was just going to make a comment, and if Dave wants to respond to it, that'd be great. But, you know, the idea that market forces completely control the oil industry is really not quite correct, because we subsidized the oil industry. We gave, in 2005, we gave $28 billion to the fossil fuel industry. So we can't exactly say that, you know, supply and demand is what's controlling.
Okay, how did we do that? What was the mechanism for that big subsidy?
Well, lobbying. I mean, that's what you know, all you have to do is look at the list of your senators and see where their contributions are coming from.
But Emma, you said we subsidized the oil industry
from the beginning of the their productions in the 1850s. So.
Well, in terms of
at the very least, the general point that the oil industry, like most industries, are supported by the state to an extent is true. It's just under AGEA, there is the provision for $500 million to help develop the pipeline. So that's effectively a subsidy. And in Congress has already approved an $18 billion loan guarantee, which they're looking to increase to $30 billion. So this pipeline does not get built without state support. By state, I mean the state and various levels of other government. So it's true. They're not just capitalists on their own strength.
Yeah. Elise,
so because of that, we can't, I mean, the public is choosing in their fear of socialism and whatever the Republican dogma is for the day, choosing to skip out on basically having a hand or a choice and making decisions.
Okay, but we're out of time, but what a great way to end the show. David Ebner, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by TelAlaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at TelAlaska, on the web at telalaska.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by AHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.